Thank you for joining us on Sound Reasoning with Christian apologist and minister Perseus Poku of AYCCE Apologetics Ministries. AYCCE is an acronym for Answering Your Christian Concerns Effectively. And it's our prayer that this program educates, trains, and empowers you to defend your Christian faith with confidence. Perseus has his bachelor's in history and a master's degree in apologetics. Enjoy this equipping time so that you may answer questions effectively. Now here's Perseus Poku on Sound Reasoning.
Welcome to Sound Reasoning. I'm your host, Perseus Poku. And on this episode, we wanted to continue our discussion on the gospel differences. Our guest is Associate Professor of Theology at Houston Baptist University, Brother Mike Licona, as well as he's the author of several books, including The Case for the Real Jesus. Brother Licona, welcome again to Sound Reasoning.
Thanks, Perseus. Glad to be on.
The last time, in terms of our discussion, we were talking about the differences between the Gospel of Mark and Matthew as it relates to the topic of divorce, and you was just clarifying what the differences are and why those differences exist. So please continue on that topic, please.
Yeah, well, so what I'm saying is Jesus, even though he didn't give the caveat that allowed divorce on the basis of marital infidelity, it doesn't exclude it from Mark.
Right.
We have Matthew who clarifies it, and Matthew isn't even exhaustive on it, because when you come to Paul's letters, 1 Corinthians chapter 7, he says, hey, if you're married to a non-believer and the non-believer wants to have a divorce, go for it.
Right.
You can have a divorce. Not a problem. So, and that even goes beyond the marital infidelity that Matthew has Jesus say. So if we were there at, let's say, the Sermon on the Mount, or when Jesus is teaching, and Jesus is speaking on divorce, what might we have heard him say? Well, he might have said different things on different occasions, of course. But on this particular occasion, he probably said, hey, if you divorce your wife and marry another, you commit adultery. But he's doing this hyperbolic language to make a point.
Right.
God hates divorce. Do not take divorce lightly.
Right. Right. And so one of the issues we face as Christians is oftentimes skeptics who attacked the Bible would often look at these passages and they'll make the statement that if it's not consistent in terms of the style of writing, if it's not the same, then they equate it to contradictions. But can you please elaborate on why that's a fallacy?
Well, you have to, just like if the way I like to talk about it in my lectures is to say that virtually every married person will understand that there is a difference between the guy version of the story and the girl version of the story. You know, the guy version, the girl version of the story, women like details, lots of details.
Right.
So they want to know what happened, when it happened, why it happened, how it happened, who was there, what they were wearing, what they said,
right,
what they thought, what they felt, and all of that. And they want precise details. Give me the girl version.
Right.
A guy, and of course I'm just stereotyping, there are
sure
many exceptions to this, but a guy version, he just wants the bottom line. Give me bullet points.
Right.
Hurry up. I don't want all these details that might be insignificant.
Right.
Compress the story if you want and all that. And we do this all the time. How many times have I been on the phone? I couldn't count. Telling the story about what happened to someone, something that happened to me, and my wife's in the background saying, you know, it didn't happen that way. And what I have done in the story is I've maybe adapted it, changed some details, because if I wanted to give the precise details, the exact details, I might have to add 5 minutes to give background knowledge so that my listener would really even understand what it's all about.
Correct.
So I might adapt some details so that I don't have to go through that for purposes of economy. And so I don't consider that a contradiction if you would take the guy version, match it against the girl version, That, in my mind, is not a contradiction.
Right.
Because I am not trying to deceive a person or mislead a person. Did it happen in precisely the manner in which I'm relaying it at that point? No. But the person gets a very accurate gist of what occurred according to the information that, of which they're interested. And that's what's important.
So going back to the connection with the Greco-Roman style writing, in terms of addition to the text or subtraction from the text, we're saying that the principal message was not harmed or was not obscured. So whether you add, they added to it or subtract for from it, the objective was to enhance the principal message. Is that correct?
The purpose was to either make your story clear, to make the point clear, or you could do some alterations to just make it better literature, to make the story better. I mean, I could give examples of that where, let's say, Sallust, who was a contemporary to Julius Caesar and who is regarded as one of the greatest of the Roman historians, one of the finest, he took a speech that Sergius Catiline, a Roman senator, had given, and displaced it and transplanted it about, several months later, 4 months later, because within that setting, 4 months later, it was a little more dramatic, it was more colorful, it still gets the point across.
Right.
He actually said that statement. But Sallust just puts it in another context.
Got it.
In order to make the narrative better, to increase the drama, he is not deceiving. He's just writing a good story, a good history. But all the points are true, and the things that were said. It's just he's doing this to make it a better story.
Got it. You touched on the divorce message that Jesus gave. Now, can you elaborate on the narrative dealing with the temptation of Jesus as found in Matthew and Luke and Mark?
Yeah, well, there's a couple things that happened there. In the first temptation, in one of the accounts, I forgot which one, and again, this appears just in Matthew and in Luke. The temptation is mentioned by Mark, but no details are provided. But in one of the accounts, Satan says to Jesus, "Hey, you're hungry. Why don't you turn this stone into bread, a loaf of bread?" But in the other account, he says, "Why don't you turn these stones into bread?" But it's the bread is there in the plural. So in one account, you've got plural. In the other, you've got singular. So all he did was something that is taught in the compositional textbooks called, the term that they use is inflection, where you change a singular to a plural or a plural to a singular. So we find that happening, just a means of paraphrasing. It doesn't change the meaning, the essential meaning. You still get the point, but it's just a way of paraphrasing. A larger difference would be the order in which the temptations occurred. So in one of the accounts, you have to forgive me, I don't recall which, but in one, you've got turned bread or stones to bread. In the second, you have Jesus being taken to the highest point of the Jerusalem temple and Satan saying, "Hey, just cast yourself off of here and angels will come and rescue you, not allow you to hurt yourself." And then the third temptation is he shows him all the kingdoms of the world and says, "I'll give all this to you if you'll but worship me." But when you read it in the other gospels, the second and third temptations are inverted, so that you actually have Satan offer Jesus all the kingdoms of the world second, and then tempt him to throw himself off the highest point in the temple as the third one. So he inverts the order. And this happens on a couple occasions. Luke is usually the one that appears to be doing the inversion. But that's some differences within the the temptations of Jesus in the wilderness.
Now, if Luke did use the reverse order, as you said, then do we know if he's doing it because of the audience, or do we not know his reason for the switch?
We don't know.
Okay.
I mean, one could guess. He's just inverting the order for paraphrase, so it's not a direct thing. Luke seems to change things and reword things more than the others, and that would be on the assumption that Mark is our earliest gospel, and as most scholars believe, Matthew and Luke used Mark as one of their sources. So in that case, what we do is we look at how Matthew and how Luke, on certain cases, use Mark as their source. And usually we see this by looking at the order in which the events are presented. If they're presented in the same event, like, 10 events in a row that appear in exactly the same order, there's a good chance that they're using Mark as the source. So in that kind of case, we do see Luke paraphrasing, changing things, altering, without really changing meaning, but changing things more than Matthew does. Matthew sticks closer to Mark than does Luke on most occasions.
Got it. And what about the transfiguration? You also talked about the differences in that narrative as it relates to Matthew, Mark, and Luke.
Yeah, well, a couple things going on there. You've got Matthew and Mark saying that after Jesus had spoken to some folks, he says they say 6 days later, Jesus took Peter, James, and John up on the mountain with him. And Luke says about 8 days later, so it's a little bit different. I'm not sure exactly what's going on there, whether Luke just decided to paraphrase in that way or what's happening. What's interesting, what I think is the interesting difference here, though, is what the voice out of the cloud, what God's voice says at the Transfiguration. So Matthew, he says, "This is my beloved son with whom I am well pleased. Listen to him." That's Matthew. If you look at Mark, "This is my beloved son. Listen to him."
Mm-hmm.
And you wonder if Matthew's getting the "with whom I am well pleased," is he getting that because it's so similar to what Jesus said or what God said to Jesus at his baptism. But then you look at Luke, it's not "this is my beloved son," it's just "this is my son, my chosen one, listen to him." So it's not "with whom I'm well pleased," it's "this is my son, my chosen one." That's a different word, and it's the same word that we would use for elect, my elect one.
Mm-hmm.
So is he beloved or is he elect? Well, I don't know what would have actually been said, but Luke is changing this a little bit. And he's communicating a nuanced meaning out of this. So, yes, God loves the Son, but this is also the one that he has chosen
right.
for the particular task of ushering in his kingdom. We find something similar, too, in the baptism of Jesus, where you have Mark and Luke, God's voice comes out of the sky and says, "You are my beloved Son, with whom I am well pleased." Whereas Matthew changes that and says, "This is my beloved son with whom I am well pleased." So, "you are my beloved son, in you I am well pleased," or "this is my beloved son in whom I am well pleased." Is God's voice addressing Jesus or the spectators? So in Mark and Luke, he's addressing Jesus. Matthew redacts it. He alters it to make a point, because he wants the readers to know that God is affirming and testifying that Jesus is his son.
Right.
So Matthew alters the meaning, or alters the words here, changes who is being addressed, the same message, but he changes it to make a point, to say he wants to underscore, underline, highlight the point. They didn't use bold letters, you know what I mean?
Right.
They didn't have a footnote in these ancient biographies. So in order to make his point, to emphasize that, he changes the people, the addressee, to make the point that Jesus is God's son.
The next narrative deals with the parable of the sower.
Yeah.
Can you touch on that for us?
Yeah, that's a pretty interesting one. Lots of differences there. So one of the things that goes on in the parable of the sower that you see, the parable of the sower, I'm sorry, I was thinking of a different one, but with the parable of the sower, you've got inversion there. So in one of the accounts, I forgot which one, but I think Mark has
20, 30, 60. Did Mark talked about the 30 and the 60?
30, 60, 100-fold. So
right.
The good seed bears fruit, some 30, some 60, some 100-fold.
Mm-hmm.
You got Matthew, he just inverts that.
Right.
And says the good seed bears fruit, some 100, some 60, some 30-fold. And then Luke subtracts, and he just says, 100-fold. So he subtracts just for purposes of economy, brevity's sake.
Right, right.
And so you've got Matthew inverting, and you've got Luke subtracting.
Three good examples right there.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's pretty neat.
And then the parable of the vineyard, which I thought was fascinating in terms of the story itself. But please talk to us about this passage dealing with the wealthy tenant and the differences in that story.
Yeah, so in the parable of the vineyard and the wicked tenants, you have the vineyard owner who prepares it, puts together and prepares this vineyard, and then he leases it out to some farmers, some tenants. And in antiquity, the way it would work is the farmers would go ahead, they'd till the land, they'd come up with the crops, and then they would be responsible for paying the owner a percentage of those crops. And that would be their payment to the owner. Well, when it came time to do this, the owner sent a servant to get what was due the owner. And, they killed the servant. And he sent another set. And then, they killed and mistreated them. And so he says, finally, let me send my son. They're not listening to my servants. I'm going to send my son. They'll listen to him. And the wicked farmers, they said, hey, if this is the heir of the vineyard, let's kill the heir, and then the vineyard will become ours. And so they cast him out of the vineyard, the son, and they killed him. So this is the parable, and it's really interesting to see what happens. Jesus says, hey, what's the owner of the vineyard going to do? Well, he's going to come, and he's going to kill those wicked farmers, and he's going to give the vineyard to another. And what Jesus is saying in this parable is Israel, the vineyard is Israel. All the servants that came were the prophets that God had sent, and they had killed, and the Jews had killed and mistreated the prophets. And finally, God sends his son, who is Jesus, of course, and they say, hey, let's kill the son, and it will become ours. And what he's saying is the Jewish leaders, they really didn't care about serving God. They just wanted Israel for themselves.
Mm.
They wanted to lead Israel. They wanted all the respect. They wanted to be the top people in Israel. So let's do it. We can own this. It can be ours. And so they killed the son. And so God is going to take Israel away from the Jews, and he's going to give it to others, and meaning the Gentiles in this case, and they got very angry at that. All right, so that's the parable. Now let's see how things change. So here's what's interesting. You have, after they killed the son, Jesus says this in Mark. He says, what will the owner of the vineyard do? He will come and destroy the tenants and give the vineyard to others. But when we read the same story in Matthew, Jesus says, so what will the owner, he takes this and he turns it into a dialogue. Jesus says, so when the owner of the vineyard comes, what will he do to those tenants? they, meaning the Jewish leaders, the Pharisees and so forth, said to him, he will put those wretches to a miserable death and lease the vineyard to other tenants who will give them the fruits in their seasons. So again, what Mark presents as a teaching of Jesus, mm-hmm. where Jesus asks and answers his own question, Matthew takes it and creates a dialogue. So Jesus asks the question, and the Pharisees answer the question. And it's also interesting, if you look at what the question is and you look at the answer, you see Matthew paraphrasing there as well. Matthew even adds to make it a little more dramatic. So that's something. Another thing that's interesting here, you have Mark and Luke say that the vineyard owner sends one servant, and they beat him and send him away. Then he sends another servant. And Mark says they struck his head, treated him shamefully. Luke says they beat him, they treated him shamefully, and sent him away. Then he sends a third one. Mark says they killed him. Luke says they wounded him and casted him out of the vineyard. And then Mark says, then he sent many others, and they beat some and they killed others.
Mm-hmm.
And then Mark and Luke says, finally, he sent the son. Mark says they killed him and cast him out of the vineyard, whereas Luke says they cast him out of the vineyard first and then they killed him. Now, when you look at Matthew, instead of sending one servant and then sending another servant and then sending a third servant, according to Matthew, he sends all three servants at the same time. And they beat one, they kill another, and they stone another. And then Matthew says, then he sent more than he did the first time. So now he sends more than three servants, and they beat some, they kill the others, and they stone others. And finally he sends a son who he kills. So what's going on here? What did Jesus actually say? I don't know what he actually said, but we really get the point that's going on here. He sends a servant, they treat him bad.
Right.
He sends another, they reject him and mistreat him too. They send another and reject and mistreat him. And then finally he sends a son. You know, that's the point. We can quibble over the details. They did not have video recorders, audio recorders, it's on this particular occasion. If you look at it in all three of the Gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, all three synoptics, it's in the same context. So whereas Jesus almost certainly gave this parable on various occasions, this is the same occasion that they're talking about in this in the Gospels, and they talk about it with different kinds of details. So I think it's just too much for us to look at every detail that's
right
there. We're not supposed to.
Brother,
Matthew, Mark, and Luke are relaying to us the gist of the story, the parable.
Brother Lacona, thank you so much. We've run out of time, but I truly appreciate this information, and I encourage those who want further study on this to do so, and also to listen to the podcast on our website. Thanks again, and thank you all for joining us on Sound Reasoning, and please consider becoming a monthly sponsor of the show.
Thanks for listening to Sound Reasoning with apologist and minister Perseus Poku from AYCCE Apologetics Ministries. It is our prayer that this lesson has equipped you to share and defend your Christian faith with boldness. AYCCE offers training in apologetics, biblical studies, and systematic theology. You can also join us for discussions on Facebook at AYCCE Apologetics. For more information, visit our website at AYCCE.org. You can also send an email there to ask questions or to support our apologetics ministry. That's AYCCE.org. Join us next week at this time, and remember, Titus 1:9 says, to hold firm to the trustworthy message as has been taught, so that you can encourage others by sound doctrine and refute those who oppose it. AYCCE, answering your Christian concerns effectively. AYCCE.org.
Hey everybody, I'm Dale.
And I'm Tamara.
And we're hosts of the Kynos Project podcast,
where we help you tackle ancient Christian truths in everyday settings.
The word kynos means new, and that's exactly what we want to do on our podcast, bring something new from what is old in our faith.
And on this show, you might hear us explore topics like what the Bible has to say about student loan forgiveness, discuss how the Satanic Temple affects our view of religious liberty in America, or even question why is it that so many people are having rapture anxiety.
To learn more about the podcast, go to lifeaudio.com.